Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again. Hope you're having a great weekend. Another full hour of the latest coronavirus and COVID-19 news coming up. We'll find out about a local study testing an antidepressant as a potential COVID-19 treatment. We'll talk with a local cardiologist about some of his cardiac concerns regarding coronavirus. And we'll hear from a local ER doctor about what she's seeing on the front lines of the coronavirus battlefield. But first, let's talk with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
This past week, President Trump unveiled his Opening Up America Again plan at the White House.
We're starting rejuvenation.
The president says several states are, in his view, ready to be reopened now. He even said in some parts of the country, people might soon be attending sporting events.
You'll be able to have those full arenas.
The plan calls for governors to phase in the reopening after cases have declined and testing is robust.
You have to pass a hurdle.
And Dr. Anthony Fauci warns the virus could return even after all three phases of the new guidelines are implemented.
It's not okay, game over. It's not.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, Washington.
Some more details. Before states begin the path toward lifting restrictions, the guidelines suggest they have a decrease of coronavirus cases across a two-week period, a return of pre-crisis hospital conditions, and an adequate supply of personal protective equipment for healthcare workers, and have the ability to set up safe and efficient screening sites. What do you think of all that, Dr. Buchholz?
I think all those are very reasonable. I think that's kind of the key pieces of information other countries have adopted that have either mitigated this or dealt with this. And, you know, it seems to be the playbook that works. The biggest concern is, we're not even close to that yet. You know, in the region here, I think this week has certainly been given a little bit of cause for optimism in the sense that the rate of increase is certainly decreasing. You know, we certainly haven't reached our peak of cases yet. And I think that's the most important part. You know, if you think about this, it's like a mountain. You know, the number of cases like a mountain, the peak is the top of the mountain. So you want to see the number of cases start to decline. And that's when you're kind of, you know, you're over the hump or over the peak. And that's when you can start to implement some of these measures. But, you know, as I've said many, many, many times, I mean, we are woefully short on testing. We are woefully short on protective equipment. And I think right now I almost feel like we've kind of made enough accommodations on the testing equipment that we're, you know, we made enough compromises and improvisations that that's probably to me the least important part. I think the fact that we can't get testing on a rapid pace is troublesome. And the fact that we've been trying to deal with this now for 6 to weeks is also, you know, bothersome. I mean, this is just the urgency with this. Is so key. And you know, really, we can't get back to getting people out and about and getting the economy going a little bit until we have that ability to kind of identify people that are sick or have this infection and prevent the spread to others. Just in our own group, I mean, it's just an absolutely fascinating phenomenon of how just in a small group of people, how quickly it spreads and how one person can make it spread to multiple people. It's just, I mean, it's just frankly phenomenal to me. And I think that's the danger of this is it spreads quick and then people can get really, really sick really fast before you know what to do. So I think that's the right parameters. I absolutely agree with it. I think the devil's in the details. And that's where I'm still very, very skeptical. And I think frustrated by the fact that we should be farther along than we are. And that's the biggest problem we have right now.
And I imagine the tracing end of this would be daunting as well.
Yeah, identifying and finding out where these contact points are, you know, is still a complicated process. All of it's made simpler if you have testing. And again, the way these tests are run, it's done by something called PCR, which is a very, very simple, very straightforward technique. It's not expensive. It's not complicated. It's pretty accurate. It can be deployed on a mass scale very, very easily. Just, you know, again, it's just a matter of material. The actual process itself is very, very well established. And so that's, to me, once you have that, you can do all those other things behind that, you know, efficiently and quickly, hopefully. So to me, that's the key.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, we're hearing that some South Koreans, about 141 of them, may have been reinfected from coronavirus. They went home, tested negative for the disease, and now they're testing positive again. A CNN doctor, Dr. Seema Yasmin, had these thoughts on what's going on with this possible reinfection.
The first, as you mentioned, is reinfection, and I really hope that that's the least likely of the three possible explanations, because if folks are getting reinfected so soon after they've already been sick, that does not bode well for how long or how short the immunity might be to this virus. But the second explanation could be this idea of reactivation, and many viruses do this. The one that causes chickenpox stays inside our bodies forever, basically, and in one third of people, it reactivates later in life as shingles. That could be the second explanation, but I'm really hoping we're looking at this third scenario, which points more to the test than to the virus itself. So we know that with every 100 tests that we do of the PCR tests, between 2 to 5 come back inaccurate, meaning we're telling people they're negative when actually they're positive. And I really hope that as we learn more, that this is a scenario that we're pointing to more and more.
What do you think of that explanation?
Yeah, that would be kind of the explanation I tend to gravitate to. It makes the most sense. I mean, the previous two scenarios that this person was talking about are not known to exist with coronavirus. Now, that's saying, you know, everything here is with a decent amount of uncertainty. But we've talked before about, you know, even with this idea of antibody tests, even with this PCR test, which is what the test that's occurring, where people have kind of a quote-unquote reinfection, it very well could be that they still have virus particles in that area and they just missed it on the testing. So, you know, I just heard an example, a perfect example of a patient that was admitted to a hospital, not our hospital, this was just from another report of, you know, they suspected COVID, they tested 3 times, they didn't get any material and they tested negative. Like they did the test, they didn't get any DNA that tested positive on this PCR analysis. The patient got sicker and they intubated them, so they stuck that tube down their throat to assist with their breathing, took samples from the lungs through this endotracheal tube, and that tested positive. So, you know, I think the test is reliable and it's, you know, 95% accurate, but she's absolutely right. Out of 100 people, 2 to 5 people are going to get a false either piece of information, either a false negative or a false positive. Although the false positive is probably a little bit low, but it's mostly probably false negatives. But at any rate, the fact that these people turned out positive might have just mean they may have had a false negative before. And again, the other kind of elephant in the room with these tests is it's just testing the RNA. It's not testing the virus itself. It's just the RNA that's the genetic material that's in the virus. The virus could be dead. The virus cannot be actively replicating, and you just have some remnant material there, and that's what's testing positive. Or it could be an active virus. We don't know. We don't know what this means. You know, does it just mean once people have symptoms and then the symptoms go away, are they cured at this point? You know, all this is information we don't know. And you know, I think it's reasonable to assume that once the RNA is gone and the test is negative consistently, it's reasonable to assume that people are cured of this disease or disease-free. This example shows you may have just done repeated tests. And I think in Korea, they do the test twice and you have to have 2 negatives before they say you're clear. There still is a percentage, you know, it would be 1 in 4,000 would still have 2 negative tests and still may be positive after a third. So it's just a math problem, honestly. That may be all part of this as well. I don't think they're going to have reinfection, but it's a possibility. I think more likely they just had a false negative test.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for your time again. Really do appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk with a local cardiologist about coronavirus, COVID-19, and his cardiac concerns. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
A small study in Brazil had to be halted early due to safety concerns after coronavirus patients taking a higher dose of chloroquine, one of those anti-malaria drugs, developed irregular heart rates. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Michael Lim. Dr. Lim is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Lim, what can you tell us about the cardiac concerns over hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, which are now being used as a possible treatment for coronavirus patients?
Well, hydroxychloroquine is a drug that's been around for a while, as you stated, for malaria, and it's also been used for some autoimmune diseases. So we know about it a bit, and it does have some cardiac issues, predominantly surrounding what we call a QT interval. And that's a fancy name for basically the conduction system of the heart. And it actually has an opportunity to slow that conduction down. And in that slowing of the conduction, it actually can promote a potential lethal arrhythmia. And that is ventricular tachycardia of the kind that we call torsade de pointes. That arrhythmia actually, like I said, can be lethal if not treated promptly. And that treatment is usually with an electric shock therapy. So this is something that we need to watch closely and assure that people don't have issues that exist before they start the therapy, and then monitor them while they get on the therapy to make sure that lengthening of that QT interval does not occur.
In the Brazil trial, the patients who were given high doses of chloroquine had the biggest problems. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, except for the fact that it's hard to predict who has this potential for this arrhythmia. And even in lower doses, you still can get it. And so care must be the word of the day in terms of the potential benefits for hydroxychloroquine in COVID versus the potential risks.
Dr. Lim, what are you seeing about heart conditions and coronavirus, COVID-19, that's causing you alarm?
There's three things. There's a concern in terms of patients presenting and having EKGs done, and those EKGs mimic what we look at from a big heart attack standpoint, what we call a STEMI, or ST elevation myocardial infarction. And the issue is that sometimes these patients don't have a STEMI. They actually have direct damage to the heart muscle, which causing the EKG changes. And so these EKGs need to be looked at very closely, number one. And then number two is there has been some talk about not taking these patients directly to the heart catheterization lab, looking at the arteries and potentially opening the arteries with balloon therapy, which would be the standard of care for patients with this type of a heart attack, but rather giving them a medication called a fibrinolytic drug. Because if we take a patient with COVID to the catheterization lab, we risk kind of exposing more people to that patient. And, I think that we need to take these patients individually and treat them very carefully. And if they are actually having a heart attack, we need to probably take them to the catheterization lab and provide them the best possible therapy. Number two is there's an issue in terms of patients developing significant heart failure where their heart doesn't actually pump very well anymore. And sometimes these hearts are going to need help either in terms of medication therapy or potentially in terms of more, which is kind of heart pumps and that type of a thing. We're very, very, very early on in the COVID era. Obviously, it's April, and this started in November of 2019. So we don't actually have the great ability and foresight to see who would benefit from heart pumps or what kind of medications would be the best to try to help these people. Unfortunately, the folks who develop heart failure are the ones that are in the worst shape. And then number three is there's a group of patients who have what we call cytokine storm. And these are patients who have elevations in things like interleukin and tumor necrosis factor. These are things that are measurable in the blood that are so-called cytokines that can actually be causing the damage not only to the heart but other parts of the body. And these are, again, some of the sickest COVID patients, and the potential for benefit in any kind of treatment, I think, is there, but we just don't know how to target that as well as we'd like to right now.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Lim. Dr. Lim is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, I've been reading that in some hospitals, they're saying they're getting a ton of coronavirus patients, but not so many heart attack patients or stroke patients these days. What do you think's going on there?
Well, that's a mystery, and this has actually been proven across the country. The overall presentation of patients with heart attacks has actually gone down during this era of COVID. The concern is that patients are actually staying away because there's a fear of going to the hospital and potentially exposing themselves to getting the virus, and so they might actually be having a heart attack at home. That's a little bit fearful because obviously the same types of treatment can't be provided for those folks at home as it can be in a hospital. But I understand the fear because COVID as a virus is not something really anybody would choose to get. The other thing would be, you know, maybe the ability of staying home and working from home has taken away a lot of stress, and people aren't necessarily as prone to heart attacks as they were before. That would be the most optimistic view, but certainly there's no evidence to support that.
What sense of security can you give these cardiac patients who are fearful of going into the hospital for a heart problem?
Well, I think the issue is this. You know, we have to have faith in a lot of different things for sure. But during this time, I think our faith is really tested. And not only do we have to have faith in making the right decisions, but we also have to put some of those decisions in other people's hands. And so we have to have faith in the fact that the folks in the hospital and the people treating you are taking your best interests at heart. So the people with COVID are separated. The proper barriers are put in place so that if you can be unexposed to a virus, that will happen for you. And that the same types of treatments will be provided to you regardless of whether you have COVID or you don't have COVID. So doing the right thing still is going to pay off. You just have to have a little bit of faith and trust that we in the hospital are managing these situations appropriately. And I can tell you that there's been countless meetings. There's hours and hours and hours of discussion in terms of developing these protocols, talking about scenarios on how to take care of patients at our hospital, and I'm sure at every other one, to hopefully put these people's fears at ease and say, look, if you really need to go to the hospital to get your heart attack taken care of, we've spent time and effort to figure out how to do that for you and make sure that it's the safest and the best possible care you can get.
Dr. Lim, we hear that people with coronary disease are at high risk for getting coronavirus and COVID-19. What if you have high blood pressure, but it's controlled through medicine? Are you still at high risk?
Yeah, so this risk thing that we're talking about in terms of heart conditions like high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, is so-called high risk. You know, this is a little bit, I think, of a misunderstood concept. The risk is not necessarily the risk in contacting the virus or getting sick with the virus that we're talking about. The risk is actually in terms of who gets sicker or who has the worst types of symptoms. And when we talk about kind of risks, according to what you asked, you know, we're looking for associations. And so we look at what are the things that are most prominent in the people who really, really got sick and maybe needed to be put on a ventilator or required to go to the intensive care unit with their COVID infection. And yes, things like high blood pressure come out, and that's how that gets on the list. Now, certainly there's nothing you can do to change whether you have high blood pressure or not. And that means that you only have one choice, and that is if you have high blood pressure, the best thing you can do is actually continue to control that high blood pressure because that's going to be the best for you overall in the long run. And then number two is pay attention to your symptoms and your overall health. And if you're not feeling well, then you need to seek attention and calling your primary care doctor up or seeking in the current times a virtual visit, which most providers are offering right now, where you can talk to your doctor over Zoom or FaceTime, over all kinds of different methodologies, and make sure you stay in the best health as possible. Again, the focus should be on you control what you can control, and these so-called risk factors, they're not necessarily changeable, and so they're just things that we utilize in the medical community to try to pay attention to some folks maybe a little bit closer than others.
Dr. Lim, anything else you want to add?
I would say this. I think the newest models from the University of Washington out in Seattle are showing that there may be an end to this virus this summer, and that would certainly be fantastic. Here in St. Louis, we certainly have been blessed by the fact that we haven't endured the number of cases that clearly they have in places like New York City or New Orleans, but social distancing is totally under our control, where we can limit our exposure to other folks. And when we do that, we limit the chances of us contacting the virus or us spreading the virus to somebody else. And so if there's any part of the social distancing that's been working in St. Louis for us, I think we need to continue to do it until we're ultra sure that the coast is really clear and that we can get out and become social again. But let's not jump the gun. Let's be patient and let's continue to do what we've been doing.
Dr. Lim, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Fred. Take care.
Dr. Michael Lim is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk with a local doctor who's been working in the ER and intensive care units at Barnes Jewish Hospital all this week. What she's seeing on the front lines. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
What's it like to be on the front lines of this coronavirus battlefield? Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Tiffany Osborne. Dr. Osborne is a critical care and emergency medicine specialist at Washington University School of Medicine in Barnes Jewish Hospital. Dr. Osborne spent this past week working in the ER and intensive care units at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Dr. Osborne, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today.
So tell me what you're seeing in the emergency room and in the ICU there at Barnes Jewish Hospital.
It's been very interesting. So when we first began seeing everybody, it was a much higher volume. So it was sort of like the beginning of a bell-shaped curve, right? So it started to increase. And then now it's kind of leveled off a little bit and maybe even decreased just a little bit as far as the volume, but the intensity is still high. And so initially we were seeing a high volume of very sick patients. And now we're seeing a lower volume, but the people who are coming in have still been very sick.
What are the most common symptoms you're hearing when they come in?
Sure. So this is one of the interesting things about this virus, is that symptoms can be all over the place. The most common symptoms are dry cough, fevers, maybe chills, body aches, and fatigue. Those are the most common symptoms. Now, also shortness of breath. And it seems like sometimes the shortness of breath starts first. Sometimes the cough starts first. But it's usually one, the other, or both. The other thing that we are seeing is a whole sort of group of things that feel like it doesn't make a lot of sense all the time. I have people who present without fever and maybe a dry cough, and some of them have turned out to be COVID positive. I've had people who come in with a mild cough, but more abdominal pain, nausea, general fatigue, not feeling well. But the cough you get after you ask them, it's not the thing they come in saying, I'm here for this. So it's been a wide range of symptoms. But the most common symptoms have been dry cough, fevers, fatigue, malaise, where they just sort of are feeling like tired all the time, shortness of breath. And then another couple of symptoms that are maybe more specific, meaning that they tend to be more so with people who definitely have it versus sensitive, meaning that you are catching a wider range. But there are a number of people who are coming in right now complaining of losing their sense of smell and losing their sense of taste, or things begin to taste metallic or rancid.
Does this wide range of symptoms frustrate you or make it more of a challenge to figure out what's really going on?
It does. And it's hard to say right now because we think that there's probably a lot of community spread and probably a number of people who may be carriers or have COVID and don't know it yet because they're not exhibiting symptoms. And it could be that they're coming in for something else and we're testing them for COVID because they can sometimes have a wide varying presentation. Or it could be that this is part of a wide spectrum of things that you can have with COVID. But it means that you have to have a high index of suspicion. And unless there's a reason to think that you don't have it, in the majority of cases, we just assume that you do, and we're testing.
And I guess sometimes for the patients, it comes as quite a surprise to find out that they do have COVID.
Yes, some of them are surprised, but I think the majority of people have it in the back of their mind all the time because we're talking about it on the news all the time. We're talking about the community spread all the time. So I think it's on people's mind, and the majority of people, when they come in, they want you to do the testing. Now, I have to tell you, though, that there are problems with the testing. The testing isn't giving us everything that we need yet. So it appears that it's very specific. So when the test is positive, we feel pretty confident that you have it. The problem is that the test is, the sensitivity is inconsistent. So that means that we can miss people. So I've had people that we've had to test, you know, two or three times, and they've tested negative. And then on the fourth time, when I'm in the ICU, I do a BAL, meaning that I actually put something into the lungs, flush out the lungs, and pull out a sample of fluid, and then send that. And then that becomes positive. So it's unclear. And then you can have somebody else who comes in completely asymptomatic and has been admitted for a specific type of surgery, and they do a COVID test for screening, and then that comes back positive. So it's very confusing as to what we do with the testing. What do we do with a negative value? It's hard for us to know right now.
We're talking with Dr. Tiffany Osborne. Dr. Osborne is a critical care and emergency medicine specialist at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Osborne, tell me about some of the complications you're seeing in patients on the heart.
Sure. So we're seeing complications in the heart, we're seeing complication with blood clotting, and we're seeing complications in the lungs. So with the heart, there are a number of people who are getting a viral myocarditis. So it's like an inflammatory infectious state of the heart. And what ends up happening is you have patients who have been very ill. They are starting to look like they're getting better. You know, we get excited about the fact that they look like they're starting to improve. And then all of a sudden they start to have these heart issues and they can have an arrest and not make it out of the hospital. It's very, when that happens, it's very concerning, and it's really hard. It's very hard for the family, and it's very hard for the team. But yes, we are seeing some viral myocarditis and complications with the heart. It's a small subset of the population who we see who are critically ill who end up with that. But we have been seeing it fairly consistently.
How are you doing on your ventilator supply and on your medical supplies?
Sure. So with our medical supplies, and I divide that into supplies for the patient and then supplies for the staff. And we are doing okay with that at this point in time. We're being conservative with it. We're trying to be good stewards. At the same time, our institution has done a fantastic job at working with us to make sure that everybody has what they need, but also providing information for us to make sure we're not using more than we need. And so we're being very cautious with it. We also, the other thing that has been happening both within our institution and within our hospital system, they've been fantastic at not only trying to make sure that we have what we need for personal protective equipment, but also in looking at outside sources and unusual sources to try to gain access for our staff. For example, all the labs in our institution for WashU, they donated their personal protective equipment whenever they shut down the labs. Medical students and engineers have been working together with 3D printers to create face masks for the staff. So it's been really encouraging to see how much of the medical community and really the general community, how everybody's been working together to fight this epidemic.
Dr. Osborne, what message do you have for the St. Louis community when it comes to how we've been dealing with the coronavirus and COVID-19?
I would really like to highlight the work that was done both by Mayor Crewson and County Executive Sam Page. When they put in that executive mandate for shelter in place, we only probably had 70, 75 cases. And I think that putting that order in place early and definitively is going to come back to really help the community. And we will probably see that when we're looking at the epidemiology of this and comparing St. Louis to other areas in the country after this is all over. The other thing that I think is really important for the community that I think they would find very hopeful is that we're doing something very unique here. BJC, SSM, and Mercy, the three largest health systems in the region, have all come together to align and work collaboratively to provide the best possible care for our community. And not every area has that kind of cooperation. So I think that that is something that is hopeful, that people can know that no matter where they go, we have all been aligning to try to provide the best possible care in a collaborative manner.
Dr. Osborne, thanks so much for talking with us today, but more importantly, thanks for putting yourself out there every day to keep us safe. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Fred.
Dr. Tiffany Osborne is a critical care and emergency medicine specialist at Washington University School of Medicine and Barnes Jewish Hospital. Coming up, we'll take a look at a local study to evaluate an antidepressant as a potential COVID-19 treatment. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer, and you're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Researchers at Washington University School of Medicine are launching a clinical trial in patients who have tested positive for COVID-19, but who are not sick enough to be hospitalized. The trial is investigating an antidepressant as a potential COVID-19 treatment. Here to talk with us is the principal investigator of that study, Dr. Eric Lenz. Dr. Lenz is a professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Lenz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell me about this study. What are you looking at?
We're looking at people who have been infected with COVID-19, but they have only mild symptoms, and they're staying at home right now. 'Cause we know that most of those people will do fine. It'll be like having the flu, and they'll get better. But about 20% can develop more serious illness with lung damage, hypoxia, and needing hospitalization. And that often occurs later in the illness, and we're looking to prevent that.
Dr. Lenz, does that second phase of the illness have a name?
Yeah, often people are calling this a cytokine storm, which is simply a reference to the fact that in many illnesses, and this is often in the case of the flu as well, but also with COVID-19, some of the damage is done not by the virus itself, but by our own body's inflammatory response. And in some people, that inflammatory response is an excessive response, which is what some people are calling a cytokine storm, and where one's own inflammatory or immune response is causing damage to the lungs and other organs.
So tell us about this drug you're investigating.
Sure. So we're actually looking at a drug that's used as an antidepressant. It's called fluvoxamine. It's actually approved in the United States to treat OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. And that's because it acts on a system in the brain called the serotonin system. But it also has another function, which is that it hits a different receptor, which is involved in inflammatory response. And basically, this action has been shown in previous studies to reduce damaging aspects of the inflammatory response during illness. And so we think it might have a beneficial effect in COVID-19 infection as well.
What patients would be involved in this study?
Right. So this is for people who've recently begun having symptoms of COVID-19 infection and gone and gotten tested and have tested positive, but then they're at home, not hospitalized. So these are people with active illness who what we would do is provide them the medication and everything else they need to monitor themselves. And we can conduct this study remotely with people. We don't come to their house other than to just drop off the kit with the medication and supplies.
So you then would check in with them on phone or computer every day to see how they're doing?
Right. It doesn't require in-person monitoring. It's all done by phone and computer. The nice thing about this medication that we're testing, fluvoxamine, is it doesn't have cardiac effects or other effects that would require laboratory monitoring or in-person visits. So the medication can be taken at home, and the whole study, in fact, can be done remotely in this way.
So there aren't many safety concerns with this medication?
Correct. If this study shows it to be beneficial, this is already an inexpensive, available FDA-approved medication. It's been around for decades, and we know a lot about its safety. So it is something that could be potentially widely used to reduce the damaging effects of the COVID infection in people.
How many participants do you need for this study?
We are recruiting about 150 for this initial study. And if the results are promising, then we would probably move on to do a larger study after that.
And how would a patient find out if they could take part in this study?
Yeah, thank you. The best way to find out is to either contact us or contact the study website. The name of the study is the Stop COVID Trial, and you can find it online at the website stopcovidtrial, that's all one word, .wustl, which is WUSTL.edu. You can also email us at this address, stopcovidtrial@wustl.edu, or simply call us 314-747-1137. We're interested in any adults who have just recently tested positive, for example, within the last few days for COVID-19 and are at home with symptoms of the illness.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Lenz. He's a professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. He's also this study's principal investigator. How hopeful are you, Dr. Lenz?
Well, of course, I'm hopeful based on the previous studies that have been done with this medication. But the point is here, this really needs to be rigorously tested before we would even think to offer it as a treatment to people. We shouldn't offer treatments just based on hope, but based on actual tests. And so that's what this study is. It's a test of whether this treatment really has promise and could work. So people participating in this study would be helping us answer this important question.
So this all comes down to good science.
Correct. There have been a lot of different potential mechanisms for reducing or preventing COVID infections, but each of them really has to be tested and rigorously tested.
Dr. Lenz, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Stay safe and stay well.
Dr. Eric Lenz is a professor of psychiatry and the principal investigator of this study underway at Washington University School of Medicine. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.